the head so hard he made his ear bleed. What his father said about it that night was, "I guess he'll know to get out of your way the next time he sees you coming, won't he, Petey?" I saw the way the boy's eyes lit up when Joe said that, and I saw how tenderly Joe carried him to bed an hour or so later. That fall, it seemed like I could see everything but the one thing I wanted to see most, a way to get clear of him. You know who finally gave me the answer? Vera. That's right. Vera Donovan herself. She was the only one who ever knew what I did, at least up until now. And she was the one who gave me the idea. All through the 50s, the Donovans were the summer people of all summer people. They showed up Memorial Day weekend, never left the island all summer long, and went back to Baltimore on Labor Day weekend. I don't know's you could set your watch by 'em, but I know damn well you could set your calendar by 'em. I'd take a cleaning crew in there the Wednesday after they left and swamp the place out from stem to stern, stripping beds, covering furniture, picking up the kids' toys, and stacking the jigsaw puzzles down in the basement. I believe that by 1960, when the mister died, there must have been over 300 of those puzzles down there, stacked up between pieces of cardboard and growing mildew. I could do a complete cleaning like that because I knew that the chances were good no one would step foot into that house again until Memorial Day weekend next year. There were a few exceptions, of course. The year that little Pete was born, they come up and had their Thanksgiving on the island. The place was fully winterized, which we thought was funny, but of course summer people mostly are funny. And a year or two later, they come up for Christmas. I remember the Donovan kids took Selena and Joe Jr. sledding with them Christmas afternoon, and how Selena come home from 3 hours on Sunrise Hill with her cheeks as red as apples and her eyes sparkling like diamonds. She couldn't have been no more than 8 or 9 then, but I'm pretty sure she had a crush the size of a pickup truck on Donald Donovan, just the same. So they took Thanksgiving on the island 1 year, and Christmas on it another. But that was all. They were summer people. Or at least 3 out of 4 of them were. Vera was the fourth. She was from away, but in the end she turned out to be as much an island woman as I am, maybe more. In 1961, things started out just as they had all those other years, even though her husband had died in that car crash the year before. She and the kids showed up on Memorial Day, and Vera went to work doing jigsaw puzzles, collecting shells, smoking cigarettes, and having her special Vera Donovan brand of cocktail hour, which started at 5 and finished around 9:30. But it wasn't the same. Even I could see that. And I was only the hired help. The kids were drawn in and quiet, still mourning their dad, I guess. And not long after the 4th of July, the 3 of them had a real wowser of an argument while they were eating at the harbor side. I remember Jimmy DeWitt, who waited table there back then, saying he thought it had something to do with the car. Whatever it was, the kids left the next day. The hunky took them across to the mainland in the big motorboat they had, and I imagine some other hired hand grabbed onto them there. I ain't seen neither one of them since. Vera stayed. You could see she wasn't happy, but she stayed. That was a bad summer to be around her. She must have fired half a dozen temporary girls before Labor Day finally came, and when I seen the princess leaving the dock with her on it, I thought, I bet we don't see her next summer, or not for as long. She'll mend her fences with her kids. She'll have to. They're all she's got now. And if they're sick of little Tall, she'll bend to them and go somewheres else. After all, it's coming to be their time now, and she'll have to recognize that. Which only shows you how little I knew Vera Donovan back then. As far as that kitty was concerned, she didn't have to recognize jack shit on a hill of beans if she didn't want to. She showed up on the ferry Memorial Day afternoon in 1962 by herself and stayed right through until Labor Day. She came by herself. She hadn't a good word for me or anybody else. She was drinking more than ever and looked like death's grandma most days. But she came and she stayed and she did her jigsaw puzzles and she went down all by herself now and collected her shells on the beach just like she always had. Once she told me that she believed Donald and Helga would be spending August at Pinewood, which is what they always called the house. You probably know that, Andy, but I doubt if Nancy does. But they never showed up. It was during 1962 that she started coming up after Labor Day. She called in mid-October and asked me to open the house, which I did. She stayed 3 days. The hunky come with her and stayed in the apartment over the garage, then left again. Before she did, she called me on the phone and told me to have Dougie Tappert check the furnace and to leave the dust sheets off the furniture. You'll be seeing a lot more of me now that my husband's affairs are finally settled, she says. Perhaps more of me than you like, Dolores, and I hope you'll be seeing the children, too. But I heard something in her voice that made me think she knew that part was wishful thinking, even back then. She come up the next time near the end of November, about a week after Thanksgiving, and she called right away, wanting me to vacuum the downstairs and change the bed linen upstairs. The sheets already on the beds were perfectly clean, of course, but clean wasn't enough for Mrs. Vera Kiss My Back Cheeks Donovan, not nearly enough. She said they smelled musty, and she had no intention of sleeping in musty sheets, or letting her kids sleep in them. They were in boarding school. But she said they might decide at the last minute to spend the weekend with her instead of staying where they were. She probably knew better, but Vera was a Boy Scout at heart, believed in being prepared, she did. I was able to come right away, that being a slack time on the island for folks in my line of work. I trudged up there in a cold rain with my head down and my mind fuming away like it always did in the days after I found out what had happened to the kids' money. My trip to the bank had been almost a whole month before, and it had been eating away at me ever since, the way battery acid will eat a hole in your clothes or your skin if you get some on you. I couldn't eat a decent meal, couldn't sleep more than 3 hours at a stretch before some nightmare woke me up, couldn't hardly remember to change my own underwear. My mind was never far from what Joe'd been up to with Selena, and the money he'd snuck out of the bank. And how was I going to get it back again? I understood I had to stop thinking about those things a while to find an answer. If I could, one might come on its own. But I couldn't seem to do it. Even when my mind did go somewheres else for a little bit, the least little thing would send it tumbling right back down that same old hole. I was stuck in one gear. It was driving me crazy. And I suppose that's the real reason I ended up speaking to Vera about what had happened. I surely didn't mean to speak to her. She'd been as sore-natured as a lioness with a thorn in her paw ever since she showed her face the May after her husband died. And I didn't have no interest in spilling my guts to a woman who acted like the whole world had turned to shit on her. But when I came in that day, her mood had finally changed for the better. She was in the kitchen, pinning an article she'd cut out of the front page of the Boston Globe to the cork bulletin board hung on the wall by the pantry door. She says, "Look at this, Dolores. If we're lucky and the weather cooperates, we're going to see something pretty amazing next summer." I still remember the headline of that article word for word after all these years, because when I read it, it felt like something turned over inside me. Total eclipse to darken northern New England skies next summer, it said. There was a little map that showed what part of Maine would be in the path of the eclipse, and Vera'd made a little red pen mark along it where Little Tall was. "There won't be another one until late in the next century," she says. "Our grandchildren will see it, Dolores, but we'll be long gone, so we better appreciate this one." "It'll probably rain like a bugger that day," I says back, hardly even thinking about it. And with the dark temper Vera'd been in almost all the time since her husband died, I thought she'd snap at me. Instead, she just laughed and went upstairs, humming. I remember thinking that the weather in her head really had changed. Not only was she humming, she didn't have even a trace of a hangover. About 2 hours later, I was up in her room changing the bed where she'd spend so much time laying helpless in later years. She was sitting in her chair by the window, knitting an Afghan square and still humming. The furnace was on, but the heat hadn't really took yet. Those big houses take donkeys years to get warm, winterized or not. And she had her pink shawl thrown over her shoulders. The wind had come up strong from the west by then, and the rain hitting the window beside us sounded like handfuls of thrown sand. When I looked out that one, I could see the gleam of light coming from the garage that meant the hunky was up there in his little apartment, snug as a bug in a rug. I was tucking in the corners of the ground sheet. No fitted sheets for Vera Donovan, you can bet your bottom dollar on that. Fitted sheets would have been too easy. Not thinking about Joe or the kids at all for a change. And my lower lip started to tremble. Quit that, I told myself. Quit it right now. But that lip wouldn't quit. Then the upper one started to shimmy, too. All at once my eyes filled up with tears and my legs went weak, and I sat down on the bed and cried. No. If I'm going to tell the truth, I might as well go whole hog. The fact is, I didn't just cry. I put my apron up over my face and wailed. I was tired and confused and at the end of my thinking. I hadn't had anything but scratch sleep in weeks and couldn't for the life of me see how I was going to go on. And the thought that kept coming into my head was, guess you were wrong, Dolores. Guess you were thinking about Joe and the kids after all. And of course I was. It had got so I wasn't able to think of nothing else, which was exactly why I was bawling. I don't know how long I cried like that, but I know when it finally stopped, I had snot all over my face and my nose was plugged up and I was so out of breath I felt like I'd run a race. I was afraid to take my apron down, too, because I had an idea that when I did, Vera would say, "That was quite a performance, Dolores. You can pick up your final pay envelope on Friday." Kenapensky, there, that was his name, Andy, I finally thought of it, "will give it to you." That would have been just like her. Except anything was just like her. You couldn't predict Vera even back in those days when she was in her right mind. When I finally took the apron off my face, she was sitting there by the window with her knitting in her lap, looking at me like I was some new and interesting kind of bug. I remember the crawly shadows the rain sliding down the window panes made on her cheeks and forehead. "Dolores," she said, "please tell me you haven't been careless enough to allow that mean-spirited creature you live with to knock you up again." For a second, I didn't have the slightest idea what she was talking about. When she said, "knock you up," my mind flashed to the night Joe'd hit me with a stove length and I'd hit him with the creamer. Then it clicked, and I started to giggle. In a few seconds, I was laughing every bit as hard as I'd cried before, and not able to help that any more than I'd been able to help the other. I knew it was mostly horror. The idea of being pregnant again by Joe was about the worst thing I could think of, and the fact that we weren't doing the thing that makes babies anymore didn't change it. But knowing what was making me laugh didn't do a thing about stopping it. Vera looked at me a second or two longer, then picked her knitting up out of her lap and went back to it, as calm as you please. She even started to hum again. It was like having the housekeeper sitting on her unmade bed, bellowing like a calf in the moonlight, was the most natural thing in the world to her. If so, the Donovans must have had some peculiar house help down there in Baltimore. After a while, the laughing went back to crying again, the way rain sometimes turns to snow for a little while during winter squalls if the wind shifts the right way. Then it finally wound down to nothing, and I just sat there on her bed, feeling tired and ashamed of myself, but cleaned out somehow, too. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Donovan," I says, "I truly am." "Vera," she says. "I beg pardon?" I asked her. "Vera," she repeated. I insist that all women who have hysterics on my bed call me by my Christian name thenceforward. I don't know what came over me, I said. Oh, she says right back, I imagine you do. Clean yourself up, Dolores. You look like you dunked your face in a bowl of pureed spinach. You can use my bathroom. I went in to wash my face, and I stayed in there a long time. The truth was, I was a little afraid to come out. I'd quit thinking she was going to fire me when she told me to call her Vera instead of Mrs. Donovan. That ain't the way you behave to someone you mean to let go in 5 minutes. But I didn't know what she was going to do. She could be cruel. If you haven't got at least that much out of what I've been telling you, I've been wasting my time. She could poke you pretty much when and where she liked, and when she did it, she usually did it hard. Did you drown in there, Dolores? She calls in, and I knew I couldn't delay any longer. I turned off the water, dried my face, and went back into her bedroom. I started to apologize again right away, but she waved that off. She was still looking at me like I was a kind of bug she'd never seen before. You know you startled the shit out of me, woman, she says. All these years I wasn't sure you could cry. I thought maybe you were made of stone. I muttered something about how I hadn't been getting my rest lately. I can see you haven't, she says. You've got a matching set of Louis Vuitton under your eyes, and your hands have picked up a piquant little quiver. I got what under my eyes, I asked. Never mind, she says. Tell me what's wrong. A bun in the oven was the only cause of such an unexpected outburst I could think of, and I must confess it's still the only thing I can think of, so enlighten me, Dolores. I can't, I says, and I'll be goddamned if my lower lip didn't start to tremble again. I could feel the whole thing getting ready to kick back on me again like the crank of my dad's old Model A Ford used to do when you didn't grab it right. If I didn't watch out, pretty soon I was going to be sitting there on her bed again with my apron over my face. You can and you will, Vera said. You can't spend the day howling your head off. It'll give me a headache, and I'll have to take an aspirin. I hate taking aspirin. It irritates the lining of the stomach. I sat down on the edge of the bed and looked at her. I opened my mouth without the slightest idea of what was going to come out. What did was this. My husband is trying to screw his own daughter. And when I went to get their college money out of the bank so I could take her and the boys away, I found he'd scooped up the whole kit and caboodle. No, I ain't made out of stone. I ain't made out of stone at all. I started to cry again, and I cried for quite a while, but not so hard as before, and without feeling the need to hide my face behind my apron. When I was down to Sniffles, she said to tell her the whole story right from the beginning and without leaving a single thing out. And I did. I wouldn't have believed I could have told anyone that story, least of all Vera Donovan, with her money and her house in Baltimore and her pet hunky, who she didn't keep around just to polish her goddamn Lincoln. But I did tell her, and I could feel the weight on my heart getting lighter with every word. I spilled all of it, just like she told me to do. So I'm stuck, I finished. I just can't figure out what to do about this son of a bitch. I suppose I could catch on someplace if I just packed the kids up and took them to the mainland. I ain't never been afraid of hard work, but that ain't the point. What is the point, then, she asked me. The Afghan square she was working on was almost done. Her fingers were about the quickest I've ever seen. He's done everything but rape his own daughter, I says. He scared her so bad, she may never get all the way over it. And he's paid himself a reward of over $3,000 for his own bad behavior. I ain't gonna let him get away with it. That's the friggin' point. Is it? She says, in that mild voice of hers. And her needles went click, click, click. And the rain went rolling down the window panes. And the shadows wiggled and squiggled on her cheek and forehead like black veins. Looking at her that way made me think of a story my grandmother used to tell about the three sisters in the stars who knit our lives, one to spin and one to hold and one to cut off each thread whenever the fancy takes her. I think that last one's name was Atropos. Even if it's not, that name has always given me the shivers. Yes, I says to her, but I'll be goddamned if I see a way to do him the way he deserves to be done. Click, click, click. There was a cup of tea beside her, and she paused long enough to have a sip. There'd come a time when she'd like as not try to drink her tea through her right ear and give herself a tetley shampoo, but on that fall day in 1962, she was still as sharp as my father's cutthroat razor. When she looked at me, her eyes seemed to bore a hole right through me to the other side. "What's the worst of it, Dolores?" she says finally, putting her cup down and picking up her knitting again. "What would you say is the worst? Not for Selena or the boys, but for you." I didn't even have to stop and think about it. "That son of a whore's laughing at me," I says. "That's the worst of it for me. I see it in his face sometimes. I never told him so, but he knows I checked at the bank. He knows damn well, and he knows what I found out." "That could be just your imagination," she says. "I don't give a frig if it is," I shot right back. "It's how I feel." "Yes," she says, "it's how you feel that's important. I agree. Go on, Dolores." "What do you mean, go on?" I was going to say, "that's all there is." But I guess it wasn't, because something else popped out, just like Jack out of his box. "He wouldn't be laughing at me," I says, "if he knew how close I've come to stopping his clock for good a couple of times." She just sat there looking at me, those dark, thin shadows chasing each other down her face and getting in her eyes so I couldn't read 'em. And I thought of the ladies who spin in the stars again, especially the one who holds the shears. "I'm scared," I says, "not of him, of myself. If I don't get the kids away from him soon, something bad is going to happen. I know it is. There's a thing inside me, and it's getting worse." "Is it an eye?" she asked calmly. And such a chill swept over me then. It was like she'd found a window in my skull and used it to peek right into my thoughts. "Something like an eye?" "How'd you know that?" I whispered. And as I sat there, my arms broke out in goosebumps, and I started to shiver. "I know," she says, and starts knitting a fresh row. "I know all about it, Dolores." "Well, I'm going to do him in if I don't watch out. That's what I'm afraid of. Then I can forget all about that money. I can forget all about everything." "Nonsense," she says. And the needles went click, click, click in her lap. "Husbands die every day, Dolores. Why, one is probably dying right now while we're sitting here talking. They die and leave their wives their money." She finished her row and looked up at me, but I still couldn't see what was in her eyes because of the shadows the rain made. They went creeping and crawling all across her face like snakes. "I should know, shouldn't I?" she says. "After all, look what happened to mine." I couldn't say nothing. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth like an inch bug to flypaper. "An accident," she says, in a clear voice almost like a school teacher's, "is sometimes an unhappy woman's best friend." "What do you mean?" I asked. It was only a whisper, but I was a little surprised to find I could even get that out. "Why, whatever you think," she says. Then she grinned, not a smile, but a grin. To tell you the truth, Andy, that grin chilled my blood. "You just want to remember that what's yours is his and what's his is yours. If he had an accident, for instance, the money he's holding in his bank accounts would become yours. It's the law in this great country of ours. Her eyes fastened on mine, and for just a second, there, the shadows were gone, and I could see clear into them. What I saw made me look away fast. On the outside, Vera was just as cool as a baby sitting on a block of ice. But inside, the temperature looked to be quite a bit hotter. About as hot as it gets in the middle of a forest fire, I'd say at a guess. Too hot for the likes of me to look at for long, that's for sure. The law is a great thing, Dolores, she says. And when a bad man has a bad accident, that can sometimes be a great thing, too. Are you saying? I begun. I was able to get a little above a whisper by then, but not much. I'm not saying anything, she says. Back in those days when Vera decided she was done with a subject, she slammed it closed like a book. She stuck her knitting back in her basket and got up. I'll tell you this, though. That bed's never going to get made with you sitting on it. I'm going down and put on the tea kettle. Maybe when you get done here, you'd like to come down and try a slice of the apple pie I brought over from the mainland. If you're lucky, I might even add a scoop of vanilla ice cream. All right, I says. My mind was in a whirl, and the only thing I was completely sure of was that a piece of pie from the Jonesport Bakery sounded like just the thing. I was really hungry for the first time in over 4 weeks. Getting the business off my chest, done that much anyway. Vera got as far as the door and turned back to look at me. I feel no pity for you, Dolores, she said. You didn't tell me you were pregnant when you married him, and you didn't have to. Even a mathematical dunderhead like me can count back 9 months on the calendar and draw the right conclusions. What were you, 3 months gone? 2, I said. My voice had sunk back to a whisper. Selina come a little early. She nodded. And what does a conventional little island girl do when she finds the loaf's been leavened? The obvious, of course. But those who marry in haste often repent in leisure, as you seem to have discovered. Too bad your sainted mother didn't teach you that one, along with there's a heartbeat in every potato and use your head to save your feet. But I'll tell you one thing, Dolores. Bawling your eyes out with your apron over your head won't save your daughter's maidenhead if that smelly old goat really means to take it, or your children's money if he really means to spend it. But sometimes men, especially drinking men, do have accidents. They fall down stairs, they slip in bathtubs, and sometimes their brakes fail and they run their BMWs into oak trees when they're hurrying home from their mistress's apartments in Arlington Heights. She went out then, closing the door behind her. I made up the bed, and while I did it, I thought about what she'd said. About how when a bad man has a bad accident, sometimes that can be a great thing, too. I began to see what had been right in front of me all along, what I would have seen sooner if my mind hadn't been flying around in a blind panic like a sparrow trapped in an attic room. By the time we'd had our pie and I'd seen her upstairs for her afternoon nap, the could-do part of it was clear in my mind. I wanted to be shut of Joe. I wanted the kid's money back, and most of all, I wanted to make him pay for all he'd put us through, especially for all he'd put Selina through. If the son of a bitch had an accident, the right kind of accident, all those things would happen. The money I couldn't get at while he was alive would come to me when he died. He might have snuck off to get the money in the first place, but he hadn't ever snuck off to make a will cutting me out. It wasn't a question of brains. The way he got the money showed me he was quite a bit slyer than I'd given him credit for, but just the way his mind worked. I'm pretty sure that down deep, Joe St. George didn't think he was ever gonna die. and as his wife, everything would come right back to me. By the time I left Pinewood that afternoon, the rain had stopped, and I walked home real slow. I wasn't even halfway there before I'd started to think of the old well behind the woodshed. I had the house to myself when I got back. The boys were off playing, and Selina had left a note saying she'd gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's to help her do a laundry. She did all the sheets from the Harborside Hotel in those days, you know. I didn't have any idea where Joe was, and didn't care. The important thing was that his truck was gone, and with the muffler hanging by a thread the way it was, I'd have plenty of warning if he came back. I stood there a minute, looking at Selina's note. It's funny, the little things that finally push a person into making up her mind. Sending her from could do to might do to will do, so to speak. Even now, I'm not sure if I really meant to kill Joe when I came home from Vera Donovan's that day. I meant to check on the well, yes, but that could have been no more than a game, the way kids play Let's Pretend. If Selina hadn't left that note, I might never have done it. And no matter what else comes of this, Andy, Selina must never know that. The note went something like this. Mom, I have gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's with Cindy Babcock to help do the hotel wash. They had lots more people over the holiday weekend than they expected, and you know how bad Mrs. D's arthritis has gotten. The poor dear sounded at her wit's end when she called. I will be back to help with supper. Love and kisses, Sel. I knew Selina'd come back with no more than $5 or $7, but happy as a lark to have it. She'd be happy to go back if Mrs. Devereaux or Cindy called her again, too. And if she got offered a job as a part-time chambermaid at the hotel next summer, she'd probably try to talk me into letting her take it, because money is money. And on the island in those days, trading back and forth was still the most common way of life, and cash a hard commodity to come by. Mrs. Devereaux would call again, too, and be delighted to write a hotel reference for Selina if Selina asked her to, because Selina was a good little worker, not afraid to bend her back or get her hands dirty. She was just like me when I was her age, in other words, and look how I turned out. Just another cleaning witch with a permanent stoop in her walk and a bottle of pain pills in the medicine cabinet for my back. Selina didn't see nothing wrong with that, but she'd just turned 15. And at 15, a girl don't know what the hell she's seeing, even when she's looking spang at it. I read that note over and over, and I thought, frigget. She ain't gonna end up like me, old and damn near used up at 35. She ain't gonna do that even if I have to die to keep her from it. But you know something, Andy? I didn't think things would have to go that far. I thought maybe Joe was gonna do all the dying that needed to be done around our place. I put her note back on the table, did up the snaps on my slicker again, and pulled on my gum rubber boots. Then I walked around back and stood by the big white stone where mean Selina sat the night I told her she didn't have to be afraid of Joe anymore, that he'd promised to let her alone. The rain had stopped, but I could still hear the water dripping deep in the blackberry tangle behind the house and see drops of water hanging off the bare branches. They looked like Vera Donovan's diamond drop earrings, only not so big. That patch covered better than half an acre, and by the time I'd pushed my way in, I was damn glad I had on my slicker and tall boots. The wet was the least of it. Those thorns were murder. In the late 40s, that patch had been flowers and field grass, with the wellhead sitting on the shed side of it. But about 6 years after me and Joe were married and moved onto the place, which his Uncle Freddie left him when he died, the well went dry. Joe got Peter Doyon to come over and douse us a new one on the west side of the house. We've never had a spot of water trouble since. Once we stopped using the old well, the half acre behind the shed grew up in those chest-high snarls of scrub blackberry. and the thorns tore and pulled at my slicker as I walked back and forth looking for the board cap on the old well. After my hands got cut in three or four places, I pulled the sleeves down over them. In the end, I almost found the damn thing by falling into it. I took a step onto something that was both loose and kind of spongy. There was a crackling noise under my foot, and I drew back just before the board I'd stepped on gave way. If I'd been unlucky, I'd have fallen forward and the whole cap would most likely have collapsed. Ding-dong bell, pussies in the well. I got down on my knees, keeping one hand up in front of my face so the blackberry thorns wouldn't scratch my cheeks or maybe put out one of my eyes, and took a good close look. The cap was about 4 feet wide and 5 feet long. The boards were all white and warped and rotted. I pushed on one of them with my hand, and it was like pushing down on a licorice stick. The board I'd put my foot on was all bowed down, and I could see fresh splinters sticking up from it. I would have fallen in all right. And in those days, I went about 120. Joe weighed at least 50 pounds more than that. I had a handkerchief in my pocket. I tied it around the top of a bush on the shed side of the cap so I could find it again in a hurry. Then I went back into the house. That night I slept like a lamb, and I had no bad dreams for the first time since I'd found out from Selena what her prince charming of a dad had been up to with her. That was in late November, and I didn't intend to do anything more for quite a while. I doubt if I need to tell you why, but I will anyway. If anything happened to him too soon after our talk on the ferry, Selena's eyes might turn to me. I didn't want that to happen, because there was a part of her that still loved him and probably always would, and because I was afraid of how she'd feel if she even suspected what happened, of how she'd feel about me, of course. I guess that goes without saying. But I was even more afraid of how she might feel about herself. As to how that turned out, well, never mind now. I'll get there, I guess. Probably sooner than I want. So I let time go by, although that's always been the hardest thing for me to do once I've made up my mind about a thing. Still, the days piled up into weeks like they always do. Every now and then I'd ask Selena about him. "Is your dad being good?" is what I asked. And we both understood what I was really asking. She always said yes, which was a relief, because if Joe started up again, I'd have to get rid of him right away and damn the risks, or the consequences. I had other things to worry about as Christmas passed and 1963 got started. One was the money. Every day I'd wake up thinking that this might be the day he'd start spending it. Why wouldn't I worry about that? He got through the first 300 right smart. And I had no way of keeping him from pissing away the rest while I was waiting for time to take time, as they like to say in his AA meetings. I can't tell you how many times I hunted for the goddamn savings passbook they had to have given him when he opened his own account with that dough, but I never found it. So all I could do was watch for him to come home with a new chainsaw or an expensive watch on his wrist, and hope he hadn't already lost some of it, or even all of it, in one of the high-stakes poker games he claimed went on every weekend in Ellsworth and Bangor. I never felt so helpless in my whole life. Then there was the questions of when and how I was going to do it. If I ended up having the nerve to do it at all, that was. The idea of using the old well as a pit trap was all right as far as it went. The trouble was it didn't go anywhere as near far enough. If he died neat and clean, like people do on TV, everything would be fine. But I'd seen enough of life even 30 years ago to know that things hardly ever go the way they do on TV. Suppose he fell down in there and started screaming, for instance. The island wasn't built up then the way it is now, but we still had three neighbors along that stretch of East Lane. The Karens, the Langills, and the Jolanders. They might not hear screams coming from the blackberry patch behind our house, but then again they might, especially if the wind was high and blowing the right way. Nor was that all. Running between the village and the head like it does, East Lane could be pretty busy. There was trucks and cars going past our place all the time, not as many of them back then either, but enough to worry a woman who was thinking about what I was thinking about. I'd about decided I couldn't use the well to settle his hash after all, but it was just too risky when the answer came. It was Vera who gave it to me that time, too, although I don't think she knew it. She was fascinated by the eclipse, you see. As that winter started to wear thin, there'd be a new clipping about it pinned to the kitchen bulletin board every week. And when spring began settling in with the usual high winds and cold slops, it got to be more like every other day. There were pieces from the local papers, from away papers like the Globe and the New York Times, and from magazines like Scientific American. She was excited because she was sure the eclipse would finally lure Donald and Helga back to Pinewood. She told me that again and again. But she was excited on her own account, too. By the middle of May, when the weather started to warm up, she was spending more time on the island than she was in Baltimore. And that friggin' eclipse was just about the only thing she talked about. She had four cameras. I ain't talking about brownie star flashes, either. In the entry closet, three of them already mounted on tripods. She had eight or nine pairs of special sunglasses, specially made open boxes she called eclipse viewers, periscopes with special tinted mirrors inside them, and I don't know what else. Then near the end of May, I came in and saw the article pinned to the bulletin board was from our own little paper, the Weekly Tide. Harborside to be Eclipse Central for residents, summer visitors, the headline said. The picture showed Jimmy Gagnon and Harley Fox doing some sort of carpentry on the hotel roof, which was as flat and broad then as it is now. And you know what? I felt something turn over in me again, just like I'd felt when I saw that first article about the eclipse pinned up in the very same place. The story said that the owners of the Harborside were planning to turn the roof into a kind of open-air observatory on the day of the eclipse. Except it sounded like the same old business as usual with a brand new label on it to me. They said the roof was being specially renovated for the occasion. The idea of Jimmy Gagnon and Harley Fox renovating anything is pretty funny when you stop to think of it. And they expected to sell 350 special eclipse tickets. Summer residents would get the first pick, then year-round residents, you had to bring your dump sticker to show which flavor you were. The price was actually pretty reasonable, $2 a throw. But of course they were planning on serving food and having a bar, and those are the places where hotels have always clipped folks, especially the bar. I was still reading the article when Vera come in. I didn't hear her, and when she spoke, I went just about 2 feet in the air. "Well, Dolores," she says, "which'll it be, the roof of the Harborside or the Island Princess?" "What about the Island Princess?" I asked her. "I've chartered it for the afternoon of the eclipse," she says. "You never," I says. But I knew the second after it was out of my mouth that she had. Vera had no use for idle talk, nor idle boasting neither. Still, the thought of her chattering a ferry as big as the Princess kind of took my breath away. "I did," she said. "It's costing me an arm and a leg, Dolores, most of it for the replacement ferry that will run the Princess's regular routes that day, but I certainly did do it. And if you come on my excursion, you ride free with all the drinks on the house." Then kind of peeking at me from underneath her eyelids, she said, "That last part should appeal to your husband, wouldn't you agree?" "My God," I says, "why'd you charter the damn ferry, Vera?" Her first name still sounded strange to me every time it came out of my mouth, but by then she'd made it clear she hadn't been joking. She didn't mean to let me go back to Mrs. Donovan even if I wanted to, which I sometimes did. "I mean, I know you're excited about the eclipse and all, but you could have gotten an excursion boat almost as big down to Vinyl Haven, and probably at half the expense." She gave a little shrug and shook her long hair back at the same time. It was her kiss-my-back-cheeks look, if I ever seen it. "I chartered it because I love that tubby old whore," she says. Little Tall Island is my favorite place in all the world, Dolores. Do you know that? As a matter of fact, I did know it, so I nodded my head. Of course you do. And it's the princess which has almost always brought me here. The funny, fat, waddling old princess. I'm told it will hold 400 comfortably and safely, 50 more than the roof of the hotel, and I'm going to take anyone who wants to go with me and the kids. Then she grinned, and that grin was all right. It was the grin of a girl who's glad just to be alive. And do you know something else, Dolores? She asked me. Nope, I says, I'm flummoxed. You won't need to scrape your damn dump sticker off the windshield of your car to get a ticket on my... Then she stopped and gave me the queerest look. Dolores, are you all right? But I couldn't say anything. The most awful, most wonderful picture had filled my mind. In it, I seen the big flat roof of the Harborside Hotel filled with people standing around like they was at a cocktail party, except they all had their necks craned back. And I seen the island princess stop dead in the middle of the reach between the mainland and the island, her decks also chock-a-block with people looking up, and above it all hung a big black circle, surrounded by fire in a sky filled with daytime stars. It was a spooky picture, enough to raise the hackles on a dead man, but that wasn't what had gut-punched me. I was thinking about the rest of the island that done that. Dolores, she asked, and put a hand on my shoulder. Do you have a cramp? Feel faint? Come over and sit down at the table. I'll get you a glass of water. I didn't have a cramp, but all at once I did feel a little faint. So I went where she wanted and sat down, except my knees were so rubbery I almost fell into the chair. I watched her getting me the water and thought about something she'd said the last November, that even a mathematical dunderhead like her could count back 9 months on the calendar and draw the right conclusions. Well, even one like me could add 350 on the hotel roof and 400 more on the island princess and come out with 750. That wasn't everybody that'd be on the island in the middle of July, but it was an almighty slug of 'em by the Jesus. I had a good idea that the rest would either be out hauling their traps or watching the eclipse from the shingle and the town docks. Vera brought me the water, and I drank it down all at once. She sat down across from me, looking concerned. Are you all right, Dolores? She asked. Do you need to lie down? No, I says. I just come over funny for a few seconds there. I had to. All at once, knowing what day you plan to kill your husband on. I guess that'd be apt to bring anyone over funny. 3 hours or so later, with the wash done and the marketing done and the groceries put away and the carpets vacuumed and a tiny casserole put away in the refrigerator for her solitary supper. She might have shared her bed with the hunky from time to time, but I never saw her share her dinner table with him. I was gathering up my things to leave. Vera was sitting at the kitchen table doing the newspaper crossword puzzle. Think about coming with us on the boat July 20th, Dolores, she says. It will be ever so much more pleasant out on the reach than on that hot roof, believe me. Thank you, Vera, I says. But if I've got that day off, I doubt I'll go either place. I'll probably just stay home. Would you be offended if I said that sounds very dull? She asked, looking up at me. When did you ever worry about offending me or anyone else, you snooty bitch, I thought. But of course I didn't say it. And besides, she really did look concerned when she thought I might be going to faint, although that could have been because she was afraid I'd go down on my nose and bleed all over her kitchen floor, which I'd waxed just the day before. Nope, I says. That's me, Vera, dull as dishwater. She gave me a funny look then. Are you? She says back. Sometimes I wonder. I said goodbye and went on home, turning the idea I'd had over and over as I went, looking for holes. I didn't find none. Only maybes, and maybes are a part of life, ain't they? Bad luck can always happen, but if people worried about that too much, nothing would ever get done. Besides, I thought, if things go wrong, I can always cry it off. I can do that almost right up to the very end. May passed. Memorial Day came and went, and school vacation rolled around. I got all ready to hold Selena off if she came pestering about working at the harborside. But before we even had our first argument about it, the most wonderful thing happened. Reverend Huff, who was the Methodist minister back then, came around to talk to me and Joe. He said that the Methodist church camp in Winthrop had openings for two girl counselors who had advanced swimming qualifications. Well, both Selena and Tanya Karen could swim like fish. Huffy knew it. And to make a long story at least a little shorter, me and Gertrude Karen saw our daughters off on the ferry the week after school let out, them waving from the boat at us, waving from the dock, and all four of us crying like fools. Selena was dressed in a pretty pink suit for the trip, and it was the first time I got a clear look at the woman she was going to be. It almost broke my heart, and does still. Does one of you happen to have a tissue? Thank you, Nancy, so much. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Selena was taken care of. That left the boys. I got Joe to call his sister in New Gloucester and asked if she and her husband would mind having them for the last 3 weeks or so of July and the first week of August, as we'd had their two little hellions for a month or so in the summer a couple of times when they were younger. I thought Joe might balk at sending little Pete away, but he didn't. I suppose he thought of how quiet the place would be with all three gone and liked the idea. Alicia Forbert, that was his sister's married name, said they'd be glad to have the boys. I got an idea Jack Forbert was probably a little less glad than she was, but Alicia wagged the tail on that dog. So there was no problem, at least not there. The problem was that neither Joe Jr. nor little Pete much wanted to go. I didn't really blame them. The Forbert boys were both teenagers and wouldn't have so much as the time of day for a couple of squirts like them. I wasn't about to let that stop me, though. I couldn't let it stop me. In the end, I just put down my head and bulldozed them into it. Of the two, Joe Jr. turned out to be the tougher nut. Finally, I took him aside and said, "Just think of it as a vacation from your father." That convinced him where nothing else would. And that's a pretty sad thing when you think about it, wouldn't you say? Once I had the boys' midsummer trip settled, there was nothing to do but wait for them to be gone. And I think that in the end they were glad enough to go. Joe'd been drinking a lot since the 4th of July, and I don't think even little Pete found him very pleasant to be around. His drinking wasn't no surprise to me. I'd been helping him do it. The first time he opened the cupboard under the sink and saw a brand new fifth of whiskey sitting in there, it struck him as odd. I remember him asking me if I'd fallen on my head or something. After that, though, he didn't ask any questions. Why would he? From the 4th till the day he died, Joe St. George was all in the bag, some of the time, and half in the bag most of the time. And a man in that condition don't take long to start seeing his good fortune as one of his constitutional rights, especially a man like Joe. That was fine as paint with me. But the time after the 4th, the week before the boys left and the week or so after, wasn't exactly pleasant, just the same. I go off to Vera's at 7 with him laying in bed beside me like a lump of sour cheese, snoring away with his hair all sticking up and wild. I come home at 2 or 3 and he'd be plunked down on the rickety back porch we had in those days. He'd drag that nasty old rocker of his out there with his American in one hand and his second or third drink of the day in the other. He never had any company to help him with his whiskey. My Joe didn't have what you'd call a sharing heart. There was a story about the eclipse on the front page of the American just about every day that July, but I think that for all his newspaper reading, Joe had only the fuzziest idea anything out of the ordinary was going to happen later in the month. He didn't care squat about such things, you see. What Joe cared about were the commies and the freedom riders, only he called them the greyhound niggers, and that goddamn Catholic kike lover in the White House. If he'd known what was going to happen to Kennedy 4 months later, I think he almost could have died happy. That's how nasty he was. I'd sit beside him just the same, though, and listen to him rant about whatever he'd found in that day's paper to put his fur up. I wanted him to get used to me being around him when I came home, but if I was to tell you the work was easy, I'd be a goddamn liar. I wouldn't have minded his drinking half as much, you know, if he'd had a more cheerful disposition when he did it. Some men do, I know, but Joe wasn't one of them. Drinking brought out the woman in him, and for the woman in Joe, it was always about 2 days before one god-awful gusher of a period. As the big day drew closer, though, leaving Vera's started to be a relief, even though it was only a drunk, smelly husband I was going home to. She'd spent all of June bustling around, jabbering away about this and that, checking and rechecking her eclipse gear, and calling people on the phone. She must have called the company catering her ferry expedition at least twice a day during the last week of June, and they was just one stop on her daily list. I had 6 girls working under me in June and 8 after the 4th of July. It was the most help Vera ever had, either before or after her husband died. The house was scrubbed from top to bottom, scrubbed until it shone, and every bed was made up. Hell, we added temporary beds in the solarium and on the second floor porch as well. She was expecting at least a dozen overnight guests on the weekend of the eclipse, and maybe as many as 20. There wasn't enough hours in the day for her, and she went racing around like Moses on a motorcycle. But she was happy. Then, right around the time I packed the boys off to their Aunt Alicia's and Uncle Jack's, around the 10th or 11th of July, that would be, and still over a week before the eclipse, her good mood collapsed. Collapsed? Frig, no, that ain't right. It popped, like a balloon that's been stuck with a pin. One day she was zooming like a jet plane. The next she was stepping on the corners of her mouth, and her eyes had taken on the mean, haunted look I'd seen a lot since she started spending so much time on the island alone. She fired 2 girls that day, one for standing on a hassock to wash the windows in the parlor, and the other for laughing in the kitchen with one of the caterers. That second one was especially nasty, 'cause the girl started to cry. She told Vera she'd known the young man in high school and hadn't seen him since and wanted to catch up a little on old times. She said she was sorry and begged not to be let go. She said her mother would be madder than a wet hen if that happened. It didn't cut no ice with Vera. "Look on the bright side, dear," she says in her bitchiest voice. "Your mother may be angry, but you'll have so much time to talk about all the fun you had at good old Jonesport High." The girl, it was Sandra Mulcahy, went down the driveway with her head dropped, sobbing like her heart was going to break. Vera stood in the hall, bent over a little so she could watch her out the window by the front door. My foot itched to kick her ass when I seed her standing that way. But I felt a little sad for her, too. It wasn't hard to figure out what had changed her mood, and before much longer I knew for sure. Her kids weren't coming to watch the eclipse with her after all, chartered ferry or no chartered ferry. Maybe it was just that they'd made other plans, as kids will do, with never a thought for any feelings their parents might have. But my guess was that whatever had gone wrong between her and them was still wrong. Vera's mood improved as the first of her other guests started to show up on the 16th and 17th, but I was still glad to get away each day. And on Thursday the 18th, she fired another girl, Karen Jolander, that one was. Her big crime was dropping a plate that had been cracked to begin with. Karen wasn't crying when she went down the driveway, but you could tell she was just holding on until she was out of Vera's sight to let loose. Well, I went and did something stupid. But you have to remember I was pretty strung up myself by then. I managed to wait until Karen was out of sight, at least, but then I...